Well, we have with us one of the contributors of The Independent, Aaron Miguel Cantu. He is an investigative journalist who has written for Al Jazeera America, Truth Out, The Nation, Vice, and other outlets. Over the last few months, he has covered much of the fallout of the cop non-indictments in Ferguson and Staten Island, and he joins us on the line this morning. Aaron, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michael, how's it going?
I'm great. Here with Mario Murillo. So, Aaron, tell us a little bit about this piece that you wrote, What the NYP Slowdown Revealed. Just outline for us as we begin what this slowdown showed and what it revealed.
Sure. Well, just to recap what the slowdown was, you know, for the end of December, early January, the NYPD significantly reduced the number of tickets and summonses that it was giving out all over the city. These were things like, you know, the minor infractions like maybe drinking in public or even stop and frisks. The number went down dramatically, and nowhere was this more apparent than places in the Bronx, places in Brooklyn, where normally NYPD presence is very high. And so, you know, there's a lot of, and this happened concurrently with a 2-week drop in crime, or at least a consistent drop in crime through the end of 2014. So many people were saying, you know, the fact that the NYPD was, you know, giving out less tickets, less engaging in less low-level activity, while crime went down, you know, that kind of showed that this policy of broken windows, you know, targeting low-level offenses is unnecessary and has no impact on the rate of crime. And so that's what people thought, you know, was the most significant thing the slowdown revealed. While I do agree that low-level infractions, you know, are completely out of hand and don't necessarily lead to any drop in crime, what I thought the slowdown's most significant revelation was the fact that, you know, Bratton was talking about the numbers not being where they are, and that there's a certain expectation, a certain threshold of numbers of stops, of tickets that need to be given out in any given point of time, and most of these tickets are, most of these summonses are written in low-income, you know, communities of color. And so what I thought the most significant revelation was the fact that, you know, the NYPD, much of the NYPD strategy is based on targeting these low-level offenses that are committed by people of color. So it's, you know, that the fact that the slowdown, so much of it was happening in these poor communities, kind of revealed how integral the strategy of stopping and really harassing poor people is to the NYPD's overall strategy.
So in your report, Aaron, you go to places like Brownsville, where obviously that's a daily constant presence, and you talk to people. What were people telling you?
It varied a little more than I thought. I mean, not everybody said they noticed a difference in the police presence. Some people definitely did. You know, they said they didn't see police on corners very much. So not only did that vary, but it even varied, you know, what people said. You know, some people thought it was good that the NYPD were slowing down, while others, you know, really disagreed with it. And, you know, I think people could find that surprising, you know, because 73rd Precinct Brownsville has, you know, and had one of the highest rates of stop and frisk. And so, you know, maybe one would expect that, you know, it would be uniformly, people would be happy that the police were, you know, had kind of calmed down, but it wasn't that way. You know, some people thought the police aren't doing their job, and that's not a good thing. So, you know, surprisingly varied, you know, despite what you might expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about how the issue of stop and frisk and broken windows you know, how it's targeted specific communities, obviously, and this is, we've been dealing with it nonstop, certainly over the last year, but clearly this has been an issue that's been going on for many years, for decades in New York City and in other communities. You know, a number of the people that you voice and you interview on the in the piece, in the article, point to the fact that, well, what we need is something else. We need to empower the communities. Could you elaborate on that and how people were reflecting that, particularly during this period of the slowdown?
Sure. So, I mean, the angle that I had kind of taken, because, you know, throughout the fallout from Ferguson and Staten Island, and, you know, when people were really in the streets in New York and around the country, and, you know, there's a certain, I guess, the left flank of the protest movement, you know, was really advocating for and still are advocating alternatives to policing. You know, what are ways that we can empower the community to handle its own problems internally without calling the cops, basically. And so, you know, while in theory, I think, you know, that would be ideal, the people that I talk with in the streets, you know, of Brownsville, none of them thought that alternatives, and I didn't ask them specifically about alternatives to policing, but none of them really voiced, you know, that. I mean, they thought that if problems arose, that they would call the cops, you know. So something that I pointed out in the piece was, you know, while radicals might think that alternatives, you know, that strong communities could make the police obsolete, our communal bonds aren't strong enough that people can imagine that yet. Mm-hmm. You know, so if people really wanted to have that sort of alternative to calling the cops when you had a problem, you know, you need to develop stronger communities so that's even, you know, a possibility on the table for most people. You know, people got to know their neighbors. People got to develop these networks so they can reach out to people that are near them, you know, in times of trouble. But it doesn't seem like we're there yet. So I think if people really want to talk about alternatives to police, we need to start building those bonds and really intentionally build those bonds, you know, before trying to advocate an idea that may seem unrealistic to most people, you know, in the city and beyond.
Right. We should say that we're speaking with Aaron Miguel Cantu, an investigative journalist who has written for Al Jazeera America, Truth Out, The Nation, Vice, and other outlets. And he has a headline piece, one of the pieces in this issue of The Independent, theindependent.com. That's IndyPendent. Aaron, what you just outlined, is that a part of the conversation at all from some quarters? Maybe not so much in the people that you talk to for, you know, that are impacted by the police on a daily basis. But is that alternative policing at all in part of the conversation?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, it always has been. You know, going back to the 1960s where you had the Black Liberation Movement developed and the Black Panthers talking about, you know, policing their own communities, you know, self-protection, you know, self-preservation. So it goes back a long way. In New York City, you know, there are groups like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, you know, People's Justice Committee. You have different cop watch cells around the city who, you know, meet weekly to talk about alternatives to police. Out in Oakland, you had some activists who, you know, it was a pretty cool event. They were able to, you know, take down the flag in front of the Oakland police station and then basically stage a protest in front of the station with a large banner that said, strong communities make police obsolete. You know, and so, I mean, these things are happening around the country, and I think at least in New York, there are a lot of people who normally who weren't part of these conversations, you know, before November, December, who have taken an interest to them. So, I mean, I think, you know, the general undermining of the authority of the police was really good for this idea that, you know, we can explore alternatives to police. So, you know, while it may not be within the mainstream of society yet, you know, I think, you know, things kind of start out on the fringe. And then more and more people kind of you know, gather over there. And then if you strategize right, you know, if you do it in a way that you can bring people into the fold, you know, an idea can really build and take hold. So the idea of alternatives to policing has a very strong tradition, has a very long tradition. That doesn't guarantee that it'll, metastasize into a mainstream idea, but I think it could be poised to do that if people went about selling it strategically to the wider community.
Aaron, as we wrap up, and I know it wasn't the focus of your article. In fact, your article came out, I think, pretty much the same day. The Independent issue came out more or less the same day, or maybe the day before or after Bratton made his kind of State of the Police discourse about a week ago, a little bit more than a week ago, where he described the creation of a new task force, kind of special force unit that is going to be armed with automatic weapons. I think there's going to be about 350 highly trained, specially trained officers who are going to be, as he put it, and I'm paraphrasing, covering and dealing with issues like what happened in France with the Charlie Hebdo massacre and the public protests, the many protests that were happening over the summer and into the fall. What do you think, or how do you see that the reaction from the folks that you've been talking to? How do they react to this as an indication of quote unquote police reform?
Sure. Well, Bratton kind of backtracked from that. In the days after, he said, that
he had no choice I think. I mean, I think people couldn't believe he actually said those things.
Right. Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, and I think the fact that he felt he could go on, television and just casually say, hey, we're going to have, 350 guys with machine gun policing protesters, I mean, that really indicated a level of confidence, that I think, people didn't necessarily know that he had, coming out of this situation. But unfortunately, Bratton, is really the one who emerged the strongest out of the NYPD slowdown and the tension between the union and de Blasio. De Blasio needed Bratton, and Bratton stayed in good graces with the rank and file police. So unfortunately, Bratton is probably stronger than he ever has been, within the de Blasio administration. Of course, that announcement, merited immediate condemnation. Which is good, and which is obvious. People would obviously condemn, such a remark.
Right.
People have been organizing in recent days to really, make a showing against Bratton. But I mean, it is unfortunate that the we're still kind of trying to regather our momentum that was really thrown off, when those two cops in Brooklyn were shot and killed. But I think Bratton coming out and saying something so brazen is really kind of good for the protest movement in a way.
Sure.
It's kind of fodder to motivate people to get back on the street, even though it's 20 degrees outside.
Yeah, well, I think this cozier, cleaner, gentler Bratton that the mayor has tried to promote, I think, is showing his true colors. Yeah, just I guess it was Wednesday it was where he called on the state to change resisting arrest to a felony charge. He said it would be helpful if that happened. So, I mean, so again, a situation like Eric Garner, where we saw it on video, where he was, I guess, resisting arrest, according to Bratton and according to the police department, because he was saying, hey, leave me alone. I'm not doing anything. Leave me alone. That will be a felony.
Right.
And so this is the kinder, gentler Bill Bratton that we're suddenly seeing.
Right. And, I mean, there's no guarantee that if it was a felony to resist arrest, I mean, I would think that the police, Daniel Pantaleo would have been even more aggressive in trying to take down Eric Garner, because then he was committing a felony, so I don't see how that
unbelievable.
It's really unbelievable, and it seems to empower the police to be even more aggressive.
Well, it should empower the movement also to be out there more, in greater numbers, because if this is the so-called reform we're going to be seeing in the NYPD subsequent to such a horrific murder that we saw on video, captured on video, that was Eric Garner, not to mention the who knows how many hundreds of other instances where there's this harassment constantly in places like Brownsville, East New York, East Harlem, and everywhere else in New York City, throughout the city, we're in for a tough couple of years. So hopefully this will mobilize people more. But this idea of the felony arrest, resisting arrest as a felony, is something that has to be really pushed back. Anyway, Aaron, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. Again, Aaron Miguel Cantu is an investigative journalist. He's written for a number of media, Al Jazeera, America, Truthout, The Nation. His latest piece, What the NYPD Slowed Slowdown Revealed is in the latest issue of The Independent, one of our community partners right here on WBAI. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael.